looking at, again, this is our fifth meeting on the Kalam argument, and we are slowly going through objections to the first premise of the argument. Remember, the core argument is whatever begins to exist has to have a cause. The universe began to exist, and therefore the universe has a cause. And so we did the second premise first, because historically that's what's debated. But of course, to our shock, what we're discovering is that more and more secularists are saying that the first premise is false. Whatever begins to exist has to have a cause is not a universally true premise. And so what we're dealing with are arguments to that effect. And we are in Paul Draper's critique of the Kalam argument, or the Kalam inference from a beginning to a cause of that beginning. And so looking at the fourth rejoinder, Draper has yet another argument in his arsenal. He says this, he says, like an infinitely old universe, a universe that begins to exist with time has always existed. For any time t, the universe has existed at t. Once again, it's far from obvious that something has always existed requires a cause for its existence. It's not even clear that such a thing could have a cause for existence. In short, if there was never a time when something does not exist, then it does not need a cause. There was never a time when the universe did not exist, therefore the universe does not need a cause. Now, unpack that one for me. What does he mean when he says there was never a time when the universe did not exist, and therefore it doesn't need a cause?
He suggests that it's eternal.
No, he's not saying it's eternal. He's saying time began when the universe began, but since there was never a time when the universe didn't exist, why was there never a time when the universe didn't exist? Because time began with the universe. And so the universe has, there's never a time when the universe was never here.
Wouldn't that make it eternal time?
Well, time began.
Well, it sounds like he's conceding a cause.
No, he's trying to argue this. Just because since time began to exist, and the universe began to exist with time, that means that there was never a time when the universe began to exist. In other words, let's say that time were itself eternal, so that long before the universe came into existence, there were an infinite number of moments of time. Then during those times when the universe wasn't around, you could say there was a time in which the universe wasn't here, right? And then the universe came into existence. Then it would require a cause. But because time itself began, there was never a time when the universe wasn't here, because whenever you have time, you always have the universe. And therefore, the universe doesn't need a cause, even though it had a beginning.
The universe is in the cause of time, right? Isn't that circular?
The universe is in the cause of time.
Well,
the universe
time,
is
time came to exist when the universe came to exist.
Right. And so nothing is the cause of time. Nothing is the cause of the universe. It just is, even though it began to be.
Chicken and egg.
Again, what we're suggesting here is that poof, the universe began to exist. And by that, we mean the space-time continuum, and there was no cause. And there was no need for a cause, because you only need a cause when you have time.
I need to start reading your responses to this before I get a question.
Well, here's the response. We showed elsewhere that it makes sense to speak of something eternal requiring a cause. In fact, you'll remember when we looked at the Thomistic argument, I dealt with the last line of Draper's argument. It is not even clear that such a thing could have a cause if it has always existed. Right? So if you look at the last couple of clauses in that last sentence, you can see that I've already responded that. Something could have a cause if it always existed. Now, whether it does or not is a different issue, and we try to show that it does. But now we're trying to look at this. What do we make sense of this idea? Well, the universe has always been here, if by that you mean has always been here for all time, because time began when the universe began. Well, here's what Craig says. He says, here Draper is the one guilty of equivocation. If always means that every time there is, that it is not true that something that has always existed need not have a cause. For if past time is finite, that thing, that is time, began to exist and so needs a cause. A cause is not needed only if always means permanently, without beginning or end. But in this sense, it is false that the universe always exists. In other words, Draper himself has not delineated exactly what he means when he says always exists. And if you delineate exactly what you mean, you can still show that time began and therefore time needs a cause. You got to understand that what they're trying to argue against at each stage of these rebuttals is they're trying to give you some sort of indication of how something can begin to exist but not need a cause. This is the strategy behind all of these rejoinders. Well, how about Dan Barker? Can Dan Barker do better? Well, Dan Barker's not much of a philosopher. He's not a philosopher. And so he's not going to do better than Paul Draper, who is a great philosopher. I don't think Paul Draper obviously did well with this, but he's a fine philosopher, fine scholar. Dan Barker is not. I think I've told you about this guy. He's a former pastor, atheist now, president of the Freedom From Religion Foundation. Usually if you read something in the news of like Christmas ornaments being taken down in the city hall in some podunk town, it's a town of 25,000 and two atheists got offended at the manger scene in the middle of times in the middle of the city square. Who did they call? They called the Freedom From Religion Foundation. And so the two atheists get to they have a great victory for secularism. The manger scene was taken down. And so we will not have any displays of religious objects displayed, you know, in the public square. That's basically what their goal is.
Schools and yeah. Even sheriff's departments who have In God We Trust on their cars.
Exactly. Yeah, they're the ones that want to get In God We Trust off the money and all that stuff. the only reason I wouldn't mind us getting In God We Trust off of our money is because I think it's a lie. I don't think that our culture really trusts in God all that much. So, my reasons for is different than their reasons. Dan Barker, Robert Price is an atheist, and he has a little blog called Mind Vendor, and he has this wonderful just critique of atheists that engage in this sort of activity. And he parodies them. He says, you know, he goes, I go to these atheist conferences, and they're like religious revivals, religious retreats, and people give their testimonies of how they stop the evil Christians from putting the manger scene in the middle of time, in the middle of their town square. And he says it's kind of pathetic, you know. It's just as cheesy as a lot of the Christian retreats you go to. And he says, I don't understand. He goes, is my atheism threatened because someone puts a manger scene in the middle of the town square? No. Anyway, we could go into that, but I'm just saying there are common sense atheists out there that don't really care about those kinds of things. Well, Dan Barker has given what we feel is a rather curious critique of our premise, that is, whatever begins to exist has a cause. He insists that the Kalam argument is question-begging, especially when it comes to the first premise, whatever begins to exist needs a cause. And this is what he says. The curious clause, everything that begins to exist, implies that reality can be divided into two sets. Dan Barker talking, and he's saying that this is a curious phrase. He says, you're assuming you can divide everything into two sets, items that begin to exist, BE for short, B, and those that do not begin to exist.
What's the point of having everything in that
statement? I don't know. This is a curious way to look at this. He goes, in order for this cosmological argument to work, the set of not beginning to be, if such a set is meaningful, cannot be empty. Now, look at the footnote. He says, in a footnote to the paragraph, he says, an empty set can be significant. It can be quite meaningful to say, I have no friends. But we know what defines a set of friends, and we can point to non-zero examples of this set in real life. A null set is significant only if it could possibly be non-null, and that can only happen if we know what constitutes an item in that set. In the case of not beginning to exist, we have no examples, so a null set would be equal to no set at all. Okay, I'm going to unpack all this, but let's keep going. He says, not beginning to be, if it is a meaningful set, cannot be empty. But more importantly, it must accommodate more than one item to avoid being simply a synonym for God. If God is the only object allowed in the set of things that don't begin to be, that's what he's trying to say. So you have in your mind a concept of things, right? And if your set of things that don't begin to exist only has God, then those things that begin to be is merely a mask for the Creator, and the premise, everything that begins to exist has a cause, is equivalent to everything except God has a cause. As with earlier failures, this puts God into the definition of the premise of the argument that is supposed to prove God's existence, and we are in fact begging the question. So what he's saying is you're engaged in a circular argument. You're saying whatever begins to exist needs a cause. And I'm assuming at the outset that there is a God that doesn't begin to exist. Right? Now, I give two responses to this. This is a very unimpressive critique. Now, why do I include it in here? Because you see these kinds of things all over the internet. First, we reject the assertion that not beginning to be cannot be null before our premise should be accepted. All we need to have in our minds is at least some analogy of what it might be like to have never begun to exist. For a human, to have never begun to exist would be to have, for example, never been born, to have always existed. For the universe to have never begun to exist would mean, for example, that if we were to take a time machine back in the past, we would never observe a first moment. For every moment we observe, there's an infinity of moments preceding it. We also have to have in our minds several examples of things and sets of which a priori could have possibly never begun to exist. On this criterion, anything we come across will do. I might never have begun to exist. It is possible that the universe never began to exist. Numbers, if they do exist, are eternal. In fact, all abstract objects, if they are real, are eternal. God, if he exists, has always existed and so never began to exist. When the first premise is offered, we are not claiming to know whether or not the universe began to exist. We are simply asking the reader to accept a proposition that he has embraced all of his life. In fact, if the previous chapters of this volume have proven anything, they have proven that we are open to the possibility of an eternal universe. It is only when we get to the second premise that we discover, a posteriori, or through observation, experiment, experience, and so forth, that everything in the universe, and even the universe itself, began to exist. And so, while we agree that the not beginning to exist set can possibly accommodate more than one item, people, numbers, and the universe, we disagree with the notion that the not beginning to exist set must, in reality, contain more than one item in order to be meaningful. For if logic, observation, experimentation, etc., bring us to the conclusion that God exists and that he is the only being who never began to exist, then so be it. We can't fault a theistic argument for proving theism. A second point we need to make is that it is Barker who has begged the question in favor of naturalism. Indeed, the assertion that not beginning to be must in actuality contain more than one item in order to be meaningful presupposes at the outset of one's investigation that the only reasonable worldview is one in which this material universe never began to exist, and or if the universe did begin to exist, there's nothing beyond it that did not begin to exist. And such a presupposition just is metaphysical naturalism. So I don't understand the point of this critique. You want to say anything about that? I've always found this thing curious by Barker.
I think it'd be easy to get lost in the...
Well, it's more interesting.
That may be the point.
Yeah, it's an intelligent sounding critique that really doesn't.
It's really an obfuscation.
It doesn't really. Most philosophers are going to see through it. Now, he's not finished with his qualifications, and he's not done yet. We have to deal with him again. He says, to say that the not beginning to exist set must accommodate more than one item is not to say that it must contain more than one item. The set might actually contain only one of the eligible candidates. The cosmological argument could be made successful if it could be shown that the not beginning to exist set contains exactly one item from a plural set of possibilities, and if the winning candidate turns out to be a personal creator. The question of accommodation is not whether the set does not contain more than one or less than one item. It's whether it cannot contain other than one. If it cannot, then the argument is circular. It would be like a dictator staging an election that permits no other candidates but himself. It's rigged from the start.
We're not saying it cannot, right?
Right.
Right. The point where we're not saying that it cannot contain that.
You're exactly right. I mean, that you've hit it. So the argument doesn't beg the question. So my response is theists do agree that the not-beginning set can possibly contain items other than God, like abstract objects, as we've already seen. And we wonder why Barker does not see this. He adds, after all, a debate of theists who have utilized an argument from abstract objects against his atheism. Michael Butler did this, for example. And Barker has to know about the famous argument between Gordon Stein and Greg Bonson. So I don't understand why he wouldn't be prepared for this. But then again, what are we to do with the curious line of Mr. Barker's, we have no experience of any not beginning to exist objects in the natural universe. How could we? Nor we can propose anything hypothetical that does not begin to exist as a real item in the natural universe. Barker's thinking here is muddled, for the fact that we have no experience of any not beginning to be objects in the natural universe is a fact that favors our premise that the universe began to exist. And when Barker insists that we cannot propose anything hypothetical that does not begin to exist as a real item in the natural universe, he illustrates an egregious confusion of categories. Of course, nothing in the real world is a mere hypothetical item. And since every real item actually began to exist, indeed, the real universe began to exist, no real item that we place in hypothetical states of affairs actually or in reality belongs to the class of not beginning to exist objects. However, this does not keep us from, hypothetically speaking, placing any or all real items within the set of not beginning to exist. For example, hypothetically speaking, if I had never been born, a fairy might have decided to think of me eternally, thereby giving me an eternal existence. Or again, hypothetically speaking, if the universe is essentially eternal, it is reasonable to think that it may have never needed a cause. These are all hypothetical states of affairs concerning actual objects which are logically possible. However, we know that the hypotheticals are false. I was born into this world, and the universe did begin to exist. Therefore, the universe, along with myself, needs a cause. But Barker is not finished with his critique. For in a footnote, he says, in the conceptual world, of course, there are things with no beginning, such as sets of negative numbers. But the thrust of the Kalam is that infinities do not exist in the real world. This, too, is a confusion of categories. And he's assuming that Platonism is true, the number one exists and has done so for eternity. But this does not commit a Platonist to the position or the proposition that there are an infinite number of numerals actually existing. Indeed, we have already seen that one can be a Platonist with respect to finite sets, but a non-realist with respect to infinite sets. In any case, there are realists who have embraced the actual existence of abstract objects, like the laws of logic, which are limited in number and never began to exist. Thus, realists need not embrace the existence of actual infinities. And once again, we have fulfilled Barker's own criterion for meaningfulness and or coherence. There are many items, conceptual, hypothetical, and natural, that can be accommodated to the set of not beginning to exist, even though nothing outside of God is actually contained in the set of not beginning to exist. Having said all of this, we suspect that Barker's criterion, as it is stated, is facile. If he were honest with us, he would admit his conviction that either the universe and all other physical objects exist in the not beginning to exist set or nothing does. In short, there is nothing in principle that can convince them that God exists. Or, in other words, Barker is the one reasoning in a circle. All right, the seventh rejoinder. Barker goes on, so he goes so far as to insist that we would never have heard of our premise, whatever begins to exist needs a cause, if it were not for theistic philosophers who wish to argue in favor of God. He writes, the clause, everything that begins to exist, sounds artificial. It is not a phrase we hear outside of theistic philosophy. It appears to be an ad hoc construction designed to smooth over earlier apologetic efforts. Now, nothing can be more false. This is just not true. I say I agree that everything that begins to exist sounds artificial, since Barker has failed to finish the proposition. Everything that begins to exist needs a cause. So construed, the premise is not artificial. Second, it is a phrase one hears outside of theistic philosophy. Indeed, it's nothing more than the causal principle, which is utilized by scientists every time they do their research. People when they make their coffee, or atheists when they write their books. The book Godless came into existence. Therefore, it needs a cause. In fact, as we have seen before, the phrase ex nihilo nihil fit was coined by Lucretius, an atheist. This is why we fail to see how the causal premise is an ad hoc construction or a product of theistic philosophy. And this goes all the way back. I mean, you find all the pre-Socratic philosophers embracing this. You find Plato embracing this. He was a theist of sorts. Aristotle, theist of sorts, embraced it. I mean, you don't find any of the Greeks denying the causal premise. It is used all the time in day-to-day lives. And what apologetic efforts it's trying to smooth over, we have no idea. Barker himself recognizes that the Kalam argument goes back a long time. We remind the reader that it has been discussed since the 6th century A.D. So I don't get that. But is he finished? No. An eighth rejoinder. Barker wonders, where do theists obtain the idea in the first place that there is such a set as not beginning to exist? By what observations or arguments is the possibility of a beginningless object warranted? Certainly not via the cosmological argument, which simply assumes that there's a set containing something that doesn't begin to exist. And not from science, which observes nothing of the sort. If theists get their initial idea from a religious document or from inner experience, their argument may be more presuppositionalist than evidentialist. Here's my response. Where does the idea of something that doesn't begin to exist come from? Does it really matter? Perhaps the idea comes from a religious document or even a religious experience. But surely Barker would not want to fault the idea simply because it is inspired from these sources. Unless, of course, he wishes to commit the genetic fallacy. This is a common fallacy. Y'all know what the genetic fallacy is. In logic, if you impugn an idea because of where it comes from, like if you say the golden rule is not good because Hitler once quoted it in a speech, then you're committing the genetic fallacy. You're saying that the golden rule is bad because Hitler said it. Let's say that the Bible is wrong about just about everything. But it has this premise, whatever begins to exist needs a cause. Actually, it doesn't have it in so many words, but let's say there's a verse, hypothetically, in the Bible that says whatever begins to exist has a cause. And the Bible's just wrong about just about everything else. And that inspired people to start thinking this way. So? That doesn't mean that the idea is wrong. In any case, it's not as though our premise, whatever begins to exist, requires a cause, presupposes the existence of a beginningless being, or if it does, such a being need not be God, for those who accept such a premise should be open to the possibility that the space-time continuum itself is a beginningless series of moments. As for the possibility of a beginningless being is concerned, we wonder how Barker could question the mere possibility that at least one being has always existed. Indeed, down through the ages, philosophers have posited all sorts of potentially beginningless objects. Abstract objects and numbers, matter, time, space, the gods, and so on. In fact, some of these philosophers, like Plato and Aristotle, had neither religious experiences nor a holy book to inspire them. But they embraced the possibility, and even the actuality, of a beginningless being nevertheless. As we saw in chapter 3, there are cosmological arguments that do, contrary to Barker, establish the actual existence of a beginningless reality. To repeat an argument we gave in that chapter, if non-being ever obtained, then it is not the case that something exists now, but it is the case that something exists now, therefore non-being is never obtained. Okay? Something has to be around forever. There has to be something that's eternal. That's the point I'm making with this argument. And how do we know premise A? It is just the principle of causality stated in another form. Out of nothing, nothing comes. Therefore, if there was once absolutely nothing, no time, matter, energy, space, people, grass, stars, grains of sand, or even moments, or even the potential for there to be something, then there would not be anything now. There would be nothing now. Which, by the way, is a contradiction. Nothing now? Okay. But something does exist, at least those reading these words would tend to think at least one thing or person is real. Therefore, it has never been the case that there was absolutely nothing. Hence, that there is an eternal something is undeniable. The only question remaining is that eternal something the universe or something else? But we now know it is not the universe. Therefore, the eternal something is other. The eternal something or other must be something else, something other than the universe. And we're going to try to argue that it is God. But notice, by the way, that in our argument at this point, we've not even shown that God exists. We've shown that whatever begins to exist needs a cause, and the universe began to exist. And that would mean that, of course, that the universe has a cause. But what that cause is at this point in the argument, we don't, you know. We agree that we have not proven God's existence yet.
So in this cosmological argument that you give, the non-being is just being that it never obtained, just means that nothingness never obtained, in other words.
Yeah.
There is something, therefore non-being or nothingness never obtained.
Right. I don't know how else to word the point. Let's say if I say there was once a time when there was nothing, I've contradicted myself.
Yeah.
Because I've invoked time in that sentence. So I have to say it in a curious way, like nothingness ever obtained. Because I'm trying to picture in my mind's eye absolutely nothing, and I can't do it. And that takes us back to Edwards' argument, right? What Edwards said is that you can't conceive of nothing, but we can define it. Nothingness is just the absence of anything. And I'm trying to give you a proposition that it doesn't just commit all kinds of logical howlers. And it's hard to do. It's very hard to do. Now, the atheist John Loftus, following the critique of the Kalam argument by Wes Morstan, a self-proclaimed Christian, insists that Craig's view of creation out of nothing is at least as counterintuitive as is the idea of beginning to exist without a cause. If someone insists it is just obvious that God could create the world without any pre-existing material stuff to work with, on the ground that there is no logical contradiction in the idea of such a feat, then the proper reply is that there is also no logical contradiction in the idea of the universe beginning to be without a cause. A few lines earlier, Loftus objected to the very idea of a cause of time itself. Indeed, the only kinds of causes we are familiar with are temporal ones. Thus, we are facing the original objection to the Kalam cosmological argument. The causal principle holds with respect to events in time, but not with respect to time itself. Now, Loftus is, of course, a student of William Lane Craig, who became an atheist. And so my... Huh?
It's a familiar story.
Yeah. A lot of these guys we're quoting were once Christian ministers to one degree or another, and they're atheists now.
I was thinking of scholars.
Oh, yeah. Okay, there you go. So here's my response. We wonder how creation or creatio ex nihilo is just as counterintuitive as beginning exists without a cause. The former posits a reality existent. A really existent being who serves as the efficient cause of the space-time continuum. True, this being does not utilize any material causes to get space-time started, which leaves us with quite a mystery, since we have never experienced the production of anything without the use of materials, like a carpenter makes a wooden rocking chair out of wood. But we at least retain the idea of an efficient cause of the effect, something with which we are all familiar – carpenters are the efficient causes of chairs. The latter postulate, if nothing else, suggests that something occurred which, as far as our experience is concerned, has never occurred. Something came into being by nothing and for nothing. Out of nothing, nothing came. Hence, creation out of nothing, while mysterious, is not wholly counterintuitive, while postulating an event that defies the law of causality definitely is. Indeed, as Craig and Sinclair note, if coming into being without a material cause seems impossible, coming into being with neither a material nor an efficient cause is doubly absurd. Second, we have offered arguments to the effect that the causal principle is no mere empirical generalization. It is analytically true and or a precondition of thought. Hence, while creation out of nothing is mysterious, it is not wholly incoherent, while those who wish to postulate an event which breaks the causal principle are committing themselves to an utter contradiction. Third, with respect to the issue of time's beginning to exist, we need to remember that on the A theory, every moment is qualitatively the same as the first moment of time. Okay, let's stop right here. Ben, what is the A theory of time?
One is a circle and one is a line.
Okay. The B theory of time says
I'm
that...
I'm going to mix them up. That's why I said it.
Okay. The B theory of time says that time is literally tenseless. So a B theorist will say that the only way we're supposed to describe events on a timeline is in terms of earlier and later than. And therefore, on the B theory, all moments of time exist at once. And so you'll remember the analogy I gave where I had the lights going across a building on a string, and you sit an electric cord through it. On the B theory, the present moment is just simply the moment where our consciousness is lit up. But when the light passes through and the lights shine in succession, even after the light shines in one light, the light still remains, even though the light is no longer shining in it. In the same way, history is really the movement of consciousness to where I am aware of the present moment. But that doesn't mean that the past doesn't exist. So on a B theory of time, there is a past to travel to and a future to travel to. Right? All time machine movies presuppose a B theory of time. On the A theory, the moments in time are literally experienced as earlier than, present with, or future from, or in the future. So that the only moment that really exists is the present moment. That's all that exists. And I would argue it's the present moment and God sustaining it in existence. Right? But that being...
I'm not sure which one was A and which one was B.
Yeah. So the Kalam argument presupposes the A theory of time, and that's why we spent a good deal of time, pardon the pun, defending the A theory. So, I say with respect to time's beginning to exist, we need to remember that on the A theory, every moment is qualitatively the same as the first moment of time. Now, why is that true? Well, because the first moment of time was the coming into existence of something brand new, a new moment. And what is this moment that we're sharing right now? It is something distinct from the earlier moments we've been experiencing. It too is brand new and never existed before and will not exist after, just like the first moment.
And in the B theory.
On the B theory,
exist simultaneously.
Yeah, they're all strung out. And therefore the first moment would be on the B theory, it's like a ray. So you have a beginning of time with an edge, right? And then you have an arrow just going out, potentially for eternity. And so the first moment of time on the B theory is absolutely unique from every other moment. But on the A theory, the first moment of time is not unique. It's the same as every other moment. Because it came into existence just like all the other moments of existence are coming into existence and going out of existence. The first moment of time no longer exists. The only thing that exists is the present. So I say this, on the A theory, every moment is qualitatively the same as the first moment of time. Indeed, the present moment the reader is experiencing is all that exists, with no moments existing before or after it. And the same can be said of the first moment of time. When it came to existence, it was all there was, with no past or future moments existing simultaneously with it. The only difference between the first moment of time and all succeeding moments of time is that it was not preceded by a prior moment of time. In light of the A theory of time, we note well the insights of Craig and Sinclair, and this is what they say. Sometimes critics of the Kalam argument will say that while it is impossible for things to come into being uncaused in time, things can come into being uncaused with time, that is, at the first moment of time. But until the premise's detractors are able to explain the relevant difference between embedded moments of time and a first moment of time, there seems to be no reason to think it more plausible that things can come into being uncaused at the first moment than at a later moment of time. If something cannot come into existence uncaused after T, where T is preceded by earlier moments of time, why think that if we were to annihilate all moments earlier than T, then that thing could come into existence uncaused at T? How could the existence of moments earlier than an uncaused event be of any possible relevance to the occurrence of that event? It's a very great insight, okay? What's the difference between the first... You say, notice what the atheists are saying. They're saying the causal premise works in the universe, but it doesn't apply to the universe as a whole. Well, what does that mean? That means that in order for that to work, they have to say that the coming into existence of time itself is qualitatively different than the coming existence of every other moment since then. But it's not.
How is that possible?
How is what possible?
How is that possible to have it qualitatively different from all other moments?
That's right. There is their burden to show that that's even a possibility. On the A theory of time, it's not possible to speak of the first moment of time being any different than any other moment. Again, the only difference is that it wasn't preceded by a prior moment of time.
But on the B theory, it would.
It would be qualitatively different. So what you would have to do is you would have to prove that the B theory is true. The atheist's only way out is to prove the B theory. Which, by the way, I think that they're going to be in more trouble with the B theory metaphysically, because now they're in trouble either way. Because now on the B theory, change is really an illusion, and now we're in pantheism. A theist can accommodate a B theory or an A theory. There are theists out there that are B theorists, right? Some people have interpreted Thomas Aquinas as being a B theorist. I don't think Thomas is, but that's irrelevant. The point is that you could be a B theorist if you're a theist or an A theorist, but you can't be a B theorist if you're an atheist, because it seems to me that you would be denying the real contingency of things, in which case you would basically be saying everything is necessary. Well, that's pantheism. The only way that everything wouldn't be necessary on a B theory time is that there is a God sustaining the B theory, the B time, right? If the B timeline, in order for it not to be necessary, it would need a cause of some kind, and it would be contingent, therefore, and it would need a cause, and therefore God would be sustaining that timeline. By the way, if you've heard of analogies of eternity where you'll say, well, eternity is kind of like a person standing on a building and they're looking at all events in a parade going in succession. They're seeing the end from the beginning in the parade. Sometimes God's eternity is cast like that. And you have to be very careful when you do that, because that would imply a B theory of time. Like God is just sort of transcending the timeline and looking down on it. And that's a perceptualist view of God's knowledge. Like God uses his eyes to see. But remember, God is not a physical being, so he doesn't have eyes to see. You got to be very careful with these metaphors.
Is there an imagery that works with A theory that we can comprehend? That would be
I have a hard time describing these things that you could imagine in your mind's eye, but I basically use a circle with a single moment like instead of a long ray that stretches out to eternity, I just have a single moment of time. And so the single moment of time is just resting in, it's existing for the moment as long as the Creator is allowing it to. Now the question is, how can an eternal being not engage in change if time is always changing? In other words, if moments are coming into existence and going out of existence, how can God be eternally unchanging?
He has to be outside of it.
I would say he's outside of it, and he just eternally wills that a temporally finite universe exist. And that the moments of succession and time are just the carrying out of his eternal decree. How can a doctor give a patient a single order to follow his medicine regimen? He gives the single order, and the prescription is carried out over time in a succession of days or weeks or whatever. That's the analogy that Thomas gave.
But doesn't omniscience and omnipresence come into that also? I mean, don't we say that in either theory, God is present in every moment in time?
Oh, yeah, he's present with every moment of time, but he's not present in every moment of time because he's not time. He's not a temporal being. He's not a time-bound being. So he exists in with... If you want
to
say he exists in with and through all times, while at the same time transcending them, I'll accept it.
So when we think of it as how he views...
Yeah, if you have him outside viewing it, you have almost a deistic model of the world. Now remember, I mean, as long as you're using these as just models to kind of get a grip on God, that's fine. Just be very careful in how we picture these things, because none of it is really accurate. I mean, it's just like when we were talking about the beginning of the universe. Where did the beginning of the universe happen? Well, it happened everywhere. So the Big Bang was not something out in empty space that just where the universe just exploded into existence. Because the beginning of the universe was the beginning of time and space. So space itself began to exist, and therefore we can only think in spatial pictures.
You can't find a point of origin.
So you can't find a point of origin of the universe. Where did the universe begin? It began right here.
Yeah.
It began in the space that I'm occupying right now. Yeah. There's no... Yeah, the space outside this building and everything.
All that.
So this should get very... This is a... Only mathematics can even describe this. And so you have to get into abstract thinking to get into all of this. But again, this insight of Craig and Sinclair's is amazingly coherent. And I shouldn't say amazingly coherent. What's amazing about any kind of coherence? It's very coherent. And so the question is, how are you going to respond to this? Well, I say that Loftus may, if he wishes, insist that the A theory of time is false, and then offer a defense of the B theory. Unfortunately, he offers no reason to reject the A theory and or accept the B theory. Instead, he offers a couple of quotations from his fellow atheists saying, quote, Graham Obbies simply notes that Craig endorses a theory of space and time that is almost universally rejected by contemporary physicists. Richard Carrier agrees, saying, here's our friend Richard Carrier, he says that though there are a few philosophers and scientists on his side, Craig's theory of time still goes against the current scientific consensus and is far from being established.
It doesn't make it false.
It doesn't make it false at all. Here's, first of all, the reason virtually all physicists accept the B theory is because, as Smith observes, and I'm quoting Quentin Smith, an atheist, who is an atheist. Smith observes, they think that Einstein's theory of special relativity implies the tenseless theory of time. And the reason they think that is because they adopt Minkowski's 1908 formulation of Einstein's theory, and Minkowski presupposes the tenseless theory of time, the B theory, in his interpretation of Einstein's theory. So notice what's going on here. Einstein's theory is interpreted by a B theorist as demanding the B theory. However, Smith responds that this presupposition of the tenseless theory of time is no more implied by Einstein's theory than is the thesis that the tense theory of time is true. In other words, the majority of physicists disagree with Craig for one invalid reason. There's nothing about special relativity that demands either view of time. Who gave the mathematical core of the theory? It was Lorentz. It wasn't even Einstein. Einstein gave many of the implications and interpretations of it. Okay? And so there's actually a debate over even whether Lorentz's understanding of relativity is true or Einstein's. Einstein has won the day, but there's still people that are Lorentzian in their view of relativity. And Einstein may himself have believed the B theory because he wrote a letter to a friend comforting this mother when one of his good friends died. He comforted her saying, he still exists, he just exists in the past. And so some people have interpreted that as his endorsement of the B theory.
It seems like a stretch.
Huh?
It seems like a stretch.
Yeah.
Well, that's an interesting proposition. So where do we... Well, what would our response to that be? Where do we bring that in? You think of something as simple as photographs as being something, a moment of time captured in the past that we can hold with us in the present.
Right.
Memory, yeah, it's a captured memory.
It's a physical memory, right, of the past. And those are comforting. And so Einstein just tries to comfort himself with the knowledge that his friend is still real. He just can't go to him. I
as long as those who remember him exist.
Yeah, he will cease existing. Like, I don't even know Einstein's friend's name. So he's lost to me. He's barely an abstraction.
So and that is what we would call, in other words, kind of the passing in and out of time or existence in some aspect, right?
Oh, yeah, they're definitely trying to capture that. But I'm not sure if I understand your question.
Well, I guess I'm just trying to understand that in terms of the A theory and the B theory. So if you think about, you know, existing, as Einstein says, existing in memory, he exists in the past, that I guess the A theory in response to that, I'm asking, what would it be? Would it be that, you know, over time, as memory dissipates and we lose those photos or whatever, that he passes out of thinking, he passes out of existing in the past, therefore kind of in some ways proving the A theory, that it's just kind of, you know, cycling in and out.
I would say, if I understand your question, I would say that for me, your existence... The existence of a past person is no different than the existence of a present person, as long as we're talking about my mind. So my memory of a past person who's no longer with us, say my mother died when I was 8. Okay, she no longer exists. On the B theory, she does. She actually exists right now. She's someone I could travel to in principle. So I could get in a time machine and go back in the past. On the A theory, time travel is impossible. There's nothing to travel to. Okay, so she does not exist at all, unless, of course, theism is true and there is an afterlife. Now, if theism is true and there is an afterlife, then I can say that my mother still exists. But that means she exists in the present. And so when I walk away, like, I'll have a memory of this conversation, and you two exist, right? But you two don't exist in my mind. You exist ontologically independent of my mind. So my memory of you is not your existence. It's just a memory.
Okay. But in the B theory, it would be, right?
In the B theory, memory would not be existence. But your memory of something past would prove that it is still real.
So I think what you're saying is that memory, that person or event...
Mm-hmm.
Its existence as a memory contingent on somebody being around to remember it.
Yeah.
On the A theory, yes. On the B theory, let's say that...
it's the tree falling in the forest.
Right. On the B theory, let's say that on the B theory, you guys get in your cars and you get in a... I don't want to cast a curse on y'all. Y'all die in a car wreck on the way home after this. So I'm the only one that survives this incident in our lives. And then let's say, let's put it this way. Let's say that all three of us get in a car wreck, but you two die and I survive. Okay, but my survival is with such horrendous brain damage that I don't remember you two. Okay, well, my not remembering you two doesn't change the fact of your current existence in the past. So on the B theory, your existence is not dependent upon memory in any way, shape, or form. But on the A theory, I see, it's interesting. On the A theory, first of all, the present moment, if that's all you have, that's all you're guaranteed, then you should live life to the fullest. I think the A theory does have a kind of application there where you should grab as much life as you can. So I think the A theory actually has a moral behind it. But as Steve Miller says, time keeps on slipping into the future. He's advocating an A theory in that song because it's that's what we're battling against. And you know, our whole life's ambition is, in many respects, the attempt to transcend time. Have you seen the movie Star Trek Generations?
Yeah, we talked about that.
Yeah.
The Nexus
is this thing that floats around in space that is literally a B theory of time where you can go to any moment in time you want and relive it. But it's not real. It's still kind of ephemeral. And so there's something even about the real universe in this nexus that's floating around that's different. And so this is the place that really matters. But this is also the place where you can't relive the time. You don't have any do-overs.
That's the thing we love, the popular society loved the idea of B theory, and I don't want to stay too much longer on this, but they love the idea of being able to go back to those specific moments in time.
Oh, and those are fun things to play with, but you know, we should call them what they are: science fiction. Now, here's the second point. Smith goes on to point out that this consensus of physicists concerning the issue of the nature of time, its tenseless nature, is irrelevant. For the tensed or tenseless issue is a matter not of physics but of philosophy. And so it can only be resolved by the source of considerations presented by philosophers. And while both Smith, an atheist, and Craig, a theist, are atheists, there currently seems to be no consensus among philosophers on which view of time is true. Okay, so that is actually out for debate right now. But what's going on right now is, while in popular culture you will see people endorsing the B theory, if you go to the average person and you say, well, how do you think of time? Most people, especially if they get into their 40s, will say, the past is past. I can't repeat it. And so most people live as atheists. And so the A theory really is the view of the common person on the street. And most people haven't thought about these issues deep enough to understand why the movies they watch are really not realistic. Right? I mean, Back to the Future is one of my all-time favorite movies. And it didn't change. When I became conscious of the A theory, I didn't hate Back to the Future. I didn't go, well, that movie's horrible because it's advocating it. No, I still love the movie because it's a wonderful thing to play with in your mind. But I also know it's pure fantasy. There's no time machine that will ever be built in the future. Like, have you ever gone to YouTube and there's conspiracy theorists actually believe that the government has built time machines? Have you ever been? And they have pictures of people in the past. Some people believe that Alex Baldwin is Millard Fillmore. And why do they believe that? President Fillmore and Alec Baldwin. Millard Fillmore looks just like Alec Baldwin. They look just alike. So there's no way that Millard Fillmore isn't really Alec Baldwin in disguise. At some point, he's going to go back in time and run these United States.
I don't mean to keep us on the track, but Is there somebody out there that would take the idea of reincarnation and kind of fuse it into this argument for B theory?
I think B theory has. I think that you have to be a B theorist of sorts. There are other theories, by the way. I've read websites, and I can't remember the nomenclature they use for these other theories. But you would have to adopt something like a B theory to be a reincarnationist. The B and A theories presume linear time. Like, we experience time on an arrow, and we're moving forward. And if you're a reincarnationist, and if you're a pantheist in general, time becomes cyclical, ultimately. So that even though it seems linear to us, that linear movement is an illusion. And so we're destined to repeat this very moment, you know, billions of years from now. So we're back, but the A theory basically just says, look, take all of your common sense intuitions. We're going to give philosophical gravitas to them. We're going to actually show why those intuitions really are true. And so if you look at the earlier pages, I gave not a detailed exploration in this, but we gave an argument for the A theory, an actual argument for it. All right. 10th rejoinder. But Loftus also identifies himself with those who feel the causal principle is not an empirical generalization that has never been falsified. He writes, David Ramsey Steele reminds us that according to quantum mechanics, things begin to exist without any cause all the time. By the way, this is the big challenge to the causal premise, quantum mechanics. So if some things can begin to exist without a cause, the universe could be one of them, which does not require a creator at all. Some have postulated that the space-time singularity, the moment the cosmos began to exist, constituted a vacuum in which something could have come from nothing. Quentin Smith has been one of several philosophers who employs the principle of ignorance, stating that one is able to know with certainty either the one is unable to know with certainty either the position or the momentum of a particle emitted from a singularity. An implication of this principle is that no physical value of an emitted particle is predictable. Hence, the Big Bang singularity would thus emit all configurations of particles with equal probability. And this is what he says. He says, it is important to understand the full significance of the principle of ignorance. If the Big Bang singularity behaves in a completely unpredictable manner, then no physical laws govern its behavior. There is no law to place restrictions on what it can emit. As Paul Davies aptly comments, anything can come out of a naked singularity. In the case of the Big Bang, the universe came out. Its creation represents the instantaneous suspension of physical laws, the sudden, abrupt flash of lawlessness that allows something to come out of nothing. Several years after making the statement quoted above, Paul Davies postulated that the universe could have come into existence through a process known as quantum tunneling. Quantum tunneling is the idea that virtual particles can pop into existence through natural processes. As we have seen, the principle of ignorance or uncertainty principle tells us that for quantum particles, there is always a minimum amount of uncertainty in contemplating the energy of the particle. Classically put, one must always be uncertain of either the position or velocity of a quantum particle. One may be certain of either, but not both. This uncertainty principle implies that the unobserved energy of a quantum mechanical particle could cause it to simply come into being from nothing. Now, many of us are aware that physicists have observed quantum particles popping in and out of existence with apparently no antecedent causes. These are what we call quantum fluctuations. If such processes can happen on a quantum level, is it not possible that the universe could be one gigantic quantum fluctuation, existing without a cause, and thus destined to return to nothingness? Indeed, Vilenkin insists that this is precisely what happened. So you might say, well, isn't Vilenkin one of those persons who says physicists can no longer hide behind the possibility of a past eternal universe? Exactly. But Vilenkin is not a theist. Vilenkin says the universe popped into being on cause out of nothing. Why? Because it's a quantum fluctuation.
Doesn't that still argue for a beginning?
Oh, it does argue for a beginning, but it's a beginning without a cause. And on the quantum level, what we're seeing is particles popping in and out of existence all the time, sans any cause. Anyway, going back to our, we had to take a break there. Going back to our point, quantum tunneling is the idea that that's what the universe is. It's just one gigantic quantum fluctuation. And as I was pointing out, Alexander Vilenkin, he gets around the beginning of the universe, the absolute beginning of the universe, by saying that the universe is just one big quantum fluctuation. This is what he says. He says, as a result of the tunneling effect, a finite-sized universe filled with a false vacuum pops out of nowhere, nucleates, and immediately starts to inflate. The radius of the newborn universe is determined by the vacuum energy density. The higher the density, the smaller the radius. For a grand unified vacuum, it is 100 trillionth of a centimeter. Because of inflation, this tiny universe grows at a staggering rate, and in a small fraction of a second, it becomes much greater than the size of our observable region. If there was nothing before the universe popped out, then what could have caused the tunneling? Remarkably, the answer is that no cause is required. In classical physics, causality dictates what happens from one moment to the next. But in quantum mechanics, the behavior of physical objects is inherently unpredictable, and quantum processes have no cause at all. Take, for example, a radioactive atom. It has some probability of decaying, which is the same from this minute to the next. Eventually, it will decay, but there will be nothing that causes it to decay at that particular moment. Nucleation of the universe is also a quantum process and does not require a cause. Go ahead.
In terms of the radioactive atom, isn't a characteristic of its existence the very fact that it decays? It's radioactive,
yes.
So it is decaying. So to say that eventually it will decay, but there will be nothing that causes it to decay at that particular moment. Well, the thing that will cause it to decay is the very fact that its properties, what makes it up, is a decaying process. It's a radioactive atom. So if that's what
exactly.
It is, it's characteristic. It's what it is the very cause of its decay.
Exactly. And notice what he also says. It has some probability of decaying, which is the same from this moment to the next. So in other words, the same probability of decay exists from moment to moment for that radioactive particle. Well, then here's the question. If it's radically contingent, as you say it is, why don't you think that it has a sustaining cause? So all he's really proving here is the radical contingency of the matter that makes up our universe.
Yeah.
That's what he's proving here.
Yeah.
He's not proving that it doesn't have a cause.
Yeah. He's proving that it needs one.
All this proves that it really needs a cause. But, again, Davies concurs with Vilenkin. This is what Davies says. He says, exotic causal mechanisms such as quantum mental processes might conceivably remove the need for a prior cause of creation. Nevertheless, one is still left with a feeling of unease. Paul Davies. Incidentally, Paul Davies, before he died, became a theist. So this is him writing as an agnostic. He moved from atheism to agnosticism and then eventually moved into the realm of theism. But whether he became a Christian or not before he died, I don't know. The 11th response. This is my 11th response to these arguments. The reader should notice that Davies felt a sense of unease at the prospect of quantum tunneling being the explanation of how the universe popped into being on cause out of nothing. The unease is most appropriate, for in the first place, our inability to know the position and velocity of a quantum event in no way proves that such events are caused by nothing. Our ignorance of a cause is not to be confused with our knowledge that no cause is there. Why they move from ignorance to knowledge of something. And ignorance is something.
Knowledge.
Exactly. They say, well, you know the old saying, you can't prove a negative. Well, they literally move from ignorance of something there to a knowledge that it's not there. How do you know that? And the uncertainty principle, quantum mechanics has many interpretations. Okay? Only one interpretation says that the quantum mechanisms are wholly random. There are 10 other interpretations of quantum mechanics which suggest that there's determination going on there. So why are you picking that one interpretation over the others? Astronomer Hugh Ross has explained there are too many problems with appealing to quantum tunneling as an explanation for the cosmos origin. This is what he says. He says, quantum mechanics is founded on the concept that quantum events occur according to finite probabilities with finite intervals of time. The larger the time interval, the greater the probability that a specific quantum event will occur. This means that if the time interval is zero, and the probability for the quantum event occurring is also zero. Because time began when the universe was created, the time interval is zero, eliminating quantum tunneling as a possible candidate to be the creator of the cosmos. Again, quantum events can only occur in time, but since time began when the universe began, quantum events cannot be the explanation for the beginning of time itself. I'm going to talk to Hugh about that when I'm out there and make sure I understand him correctly. But that aside, besides, modern physicists are disputing a number of issues regarding quantum mechanics, everything from whether or not virtual particles exist to whether the standard Copenhagen interpretation of quantum events is even true. And even on the standard interpretation of quantum events, particles do not come into being out of nothing. They arise as spontaneous fluctuations of energy contained in the subatomic vacuum, which constitutes an indeterministic cause of their origin. Therefore, popularizers touting such theories as getting something from nothing apparently do not understand that the vacuum is not nothing, but is a sea of fluctuating energy endowed with a rich structure and subject to physical laws, even as Ross has explained. And so, these popular models do not involve a true origination ex nihilo. Quentin Smith, virtually admits this, stating that the majority, or the singularity rather, is nothing only in the metaphorical sense that it is a referent to something not a part of the four-dimensional space-time continuum. If by nothing, he had literally meant nothing, no minds, energy, space, time, etc., nothing, then it would appear that his proposal would run into significant problems. As Mark Worthing so aptly notes, when the question is examined seriously and nothing is not loosely defined, it would seem that there can be no true creation ex nihilo without God. From the perspective of philosophy, when the postulate of a divine creator is removed, we seem to be left with the unanswered naked dictum, ex nihilo nihil fit, nothing comes out of nothing. Even from the perspective of physics, it is questionable whether a functional theory containing a true creatio ex nihilo is within the realm of possibility. When we finally come to Vilenkin's proposal, we find it lacking in coherence. As Craig and Sinclair argue, Vilenkin invites us to envision a small, closed, spherical universe filled with a so-called false vacuum and containing some ordinary matter. If the radius of such a universe is small, classical physics predicts that it will collapse to a point. But quantum physics permits it to tunnel into a state of inflationary expansion. If we allow the radius to shrink all the way to zero, there still remains some positive probability of the universe's tunneling into inflation. As we have seen, Vilenkin equates the initial state of the universe explanatorily prior to tunneling with nothingness. But postulating such an equivalence is grossly misleading. As Vilenkin's own diagram illustrates, quantum tunneling is at every point a function from something to something. For quantum tunneling to be truly from nothing, the function would have to have only one term, the posterior term. Another way of seeing the point is to reflect on the fact that to have no radius, as is the case with nothingness, is not to have a radius whose measure is zero. Thus, there is no basis for the claim that quantum physics proves that things can begin to exist without a cause, much less that a universe could have sprung into being uncaused from literally nothing. So what are they getting at here? Vilenkin's own illustrations don't get you the quantum process that Vilenkin is talking about does not remove him from something already existing there prior to the quantum fluctuation. And yet Lincoln himself says that you cannot hide behind the possibility of a past eternal universe. He says the universe had a beginning. He says this very strongly. After Craig and Sinclair wrote these words, Craig was at a conference in England and listened to Vilenkin speak, and they said, what is the state of the evidence concerning the beginning of the universe? He says, all the evidence is now pointing to a beginning of the universe. Not that there's more evidence for a beginning than not a beginning, but that all the evidence is pointing in that direction. So when you're saying something like that, then clearly your quantum tunneling is not an explanation for the beginning of the universe. It may be the explanation for the beginning of inflation, right? But that's a different thing altogether. And that's what Craig and Sinclair are getting at. That's not creation. That's just expansion of the universe. And that's a different issue.
You get them to conceive the beginning.
Once you get into the conceit of beginning, it's very difficult to get around a cause of the beginning. Vilenkin may respond that for him, quantum tunneling is not offered as an example of creation of absolutely nothing. Rather, he suggests the laws of physics exist prior to the universe, and as the quantum tunneling of the universe exists, into existence was governed by physical law. However, we should point out that it was precisely the lawlessness of the singularity that supposedly allowed quantum tunneling to occur in the first place. Now we are offered a metaphysical hypothesis suggesting that the laws of physics existed before there were any physical processes or time or space. In any case, what the evidence suggests that at the moment of singularity, there were no physical laws. We can trace the cosmos history back to 10 to the negative 43 second after its origination. And while this is not exactly t equals zero, it is close enough to warrant the conclusion that nothing in our cosmos, including the laws which govern it, existed prior to the Big Bang. As Craig puts it, the singularity has no positive ontological status. As one traces the cosmic expansion back in time, the singularity represents the point at which the universe ceases to exist. The breakdown of the laws of physics and the attendant unpredictability of quantum particles is perspicuous in light of the fact that nothingness possesses no physics. What does it mean to say that the laws of physics preceded the universe?
That doesn't make sense to me. The laws explain the physical processes. Without the physical processes, there would be no need for the law. Right?
I've written this. This is in my new book, but then I'm taking it out because it's not really relevant to what I'm doing there. And I'm not going to read all of it to you, but I'm going to. I might not even read any of it to you. I might just let you have it. But I get into the philosophy and the theology of what it means for God to create, you know, in there. And I answer Vilenkin's claim. But Vilenkin asks the question, he goes, on what tablet are these laws of physics written? See, if the laws of physics precede the universe, they are really abstract, immaterial laws that govern the universe. And what does it mean to say that a physical law that governs the universe and brings it into existence, what does it even mean to talk that way? Shouldn't we say that the tablet upon which those laws are written is a mind? And if you read what I've written here, Vilenkin actually suggests such a thing, that maybe it's a mind. Well, then we're talking about God here. So he's not escaped at all the existence of God, even though he has tried valiantly to do so. I say this, we saw earlier that Paul Davies felt a little uneasy in postulating quantum tunneling as an explanation of the universe's origin. And it's noteworthy that he eventually rejected it as an explanation of cosmic origins. And I put in the footnote, while he is still rejecting the theistic notion of creation ex nihilo, he does accept the idea that some kind of supernatural entity or being exists. And I cite The Mind of God, a work that he wrote in the 90s. I think he evolved from there to a more theistic position. Yeah, later in his life. But again, I don't know for sure. Edmund Whittaker's words, which addressed a version of this self-creation scenario we've been discussing, still ring true. He says, "There is no ground for supposing that matter and energy, or for that matter, the laws of physics, existed before the universe began and were suddenly galvanized into action. For what could distinguish that moment from all other moments in eternity? In other words, how could impersonal laws of physics, which per Vilenkin's hypothesis are eternal, and or bare chaotic energy, ensure that their effect is temporally finite? It is simpler to postulate creation ex nihilo, divine will constituting nature from nothingness." So that brings us to the conclusion of our defense of premise B. Vilenkin, Bord, and Guth have demonstrated that the universe that has been expanding through its that any universe that has been expanding throughout its history cannot be infinite in the past, but must have a past space-time boundary. The universe must have had a beginning. We think that it is in light of the evidence for the beginning of the cosmos that the first premise A of our calm cosmological argument is being challenged by those who wish to deny or at least avoid a theistic conclusion. In fact, I met with the president of the Atheists in Albany. Did I tell you all this story before?
I remember you saying you met with him. I don't remember what you discussed.
Okay, well, I might be repeating the story, but in the discussion, we met at the Harvest Moon, and in the discussion, he was not really citing many really good atheist philosophers, and so I ended up recommending him books to help him defend his own position, because I didn't understand why he thought it was so irrational to be a theist, and yet he himself was clearly not familiar with the issues. And as we were talking, we went into the Kalam argument, and I said, you know, whatever begins to exist needs a cause. I said, you would agree that anybody that would reject that idea is, that's just crazy, right? And he said, oh, of course. And I said, what about the universe began to exist? And by the way, this whole discussion was preceded by young earth creationism, and he went on and on about how young earth creationists are being dishonest, and that he goes, I'm not a scientist, but I have no choice but to accept what the majority of scientists are saying. I said, fine. So we got to premise B of the Kalam argument, where the universe began to exist, and I said, you would agree with the majority of scientists that talk about this, that the universe began to exist. And he said, well, yeah. He goes, I can't get around that. And I said, so, well, then the universe has a cause. He goes, well, what caused the cause of the universe? I said, well, let me say two things about that. First of all, the cause of the universe's coming into existence, if I establish that that exists, then I have, by definition, refuted naturalism. Well, how so? Because it's the cause of the universe, unless you want to say something like the universe created itself, which is just crazy. You can't exist before you exist. You can't create yourself. Well, by the end of the discussion, this guy started denying the first premise of the argument. Yeah, he started saying, well, that just because things have a cause in time doesn't mean that time itself has to have a cause. So that's actually where everyone's going to go, because they can't deny what the scientists are saying, but they can't accept the conclusion of the argument. So this is an example of what Alvin Plantinga says. You can sometimes reduce a person to ignorance through a sound argument. Because the question now becomes, what premise are you going to give up? Are you going to give up the first one, whatever begins to exist needs a cause, or the second one, the universe began to exist? You got to give up one of those, or else the argument follows through and your naturalism is done for. Because if you have a cause of the universe, you by definition have a cause that transcends the universe. By the way, the second point I gave to him is the cause of the universe must by definition transcend time, and therefore it would not need a prior cause of its existence. Anyway, he started questioning the second premise by the end of the discussion. Because I laid into him about whatever begins to exist needs a cause. defended the causal premise, and then he jumped to, well, maybe the universe is eternal after all. Well, now you're denying what most scientists accept, and therefore you're in the same position as a young Earth creationist.
Scientism over science.
Right? Well, he's rejecting scientism because if scientism is science is the paradigm of rationality, and if the majority of scientists are saying the universe had a beginning, then you must reject scientism.
My thought is that a lot of the atheists that try to embrace science, well, you know, I've said this before, don't do it to embrace the science. It's just the antithesis of what they don't want to. So.
Right, they do it to reject a certain religious conclusion.
Most of the scientists who actually follow science and try to go with based on what they can prove and what they can see
right.
and confirm are more of an agnostic.
Right, exactly. I would agree. By the way, on footnote 170, I point this out. Even if those who postulate a multiverse are correct, what is a multiverse? It's the belief that literally an infinite number of universes exist. Even if they are correct, such would at best only invalidate some of the teleological arguments being explored today. So in other words, some of you are aware of the fine-tuning argument, which we will get into. The multiverse would refute the fine-tuning argument if the multiverse is true. And as an aside, let me also say this. I know Christians who actually think the multiverse exists, and they think that the fine-tuning argument is a good argument. So the multiverse would not even refute the fine-tuning argument in the minds of some Christian physicists. Okay, but having said that, at most the multiverse would refute the fine-tuning argument. But if the multiverse really does exist, it would not invalidate the Kalam argument. That's what you need to understand. So you can't get around the Kalam argument by appealing to the multiverse. The Bohr-Guth-Fehling theorem has demonstrated that even those parallel worlds, because they too are expanding, must have had an absolute origin of their existence. Of course, someone may wish to deny that these other worlds are expanding, but then again, such worlds become wholly unlike the one we are experiencing and thus fail to be parallel to ours. Right? If you say, well, I believe in parallel worlds that are not expanding, well, then they're not parallel because ours is expanding. We think that the postulate of a static or unchanging eternal and independent world ensemble is no way to avoid metaphysics, and when extrapolated to its logical conclusion, starts to look a lot like a divine being. Okay? So, what is our defense of the second premise of the Kalam argument? The causal premise, which is the first premise of the Kalam argument. Let me back up. What is our defense of the first premise of the Kalam argument? We've already defended the second one. The first premise is the causal principle. And we say that it's analytically true, a precondition of thought, and an empirical generalization that is constantly verified and has never been falsified. And we have found the various attempts to avoid our premise to be invalid. Hence, we conclude with the colorful insights of C.D. Broad, this great atheistic philosopher of the past. And he says this, now, if I may make some personal confessions, I find no difficulty in supposing that the world's history had no beginning and that its duration backwards from its present phase is infinite. Nor do I find any insuperable difficulty in supposing that the world's history had no beginning, but that its duration backwards from its present phase does not exceed a certain finite limiting value. But I must confess that I have a very great difficulty in supposing that there was a first phase in the world's history, that is, a phase immediately before which there existed neither matter nor minds nor anything else. I suspect that my difficulty about a first event or phase in the world's history is due to the fact that whatever I may say when I'm trying to give David Hume a run for his money, I cannot really believe in anything beginning to exist without being caused in the old-fashioned sense of produced or generated by something else which existed before and up to the moment when the entity in question began to exist. This principle has no trace of self-evidence when cause is interpreted in terms of law and not in terms of generation is, of course, irrelevant. When cause is interpreted in terms of generation, I do find it impossible to give up the principle, and with that confession of the intellectual impotence of old age, I must leave this topic. So we're leaving the topic of the first premise. And so that gives us our conclusion, doesn't it? If the first two premises are true, then the conclusion automatically follows. The universe required a cause for its coming into existence. As we tried to demonstrate in chapters 4 through 5, the Thomistic cosmological argument from contingency demonstrated that even if the universe is past eternal, it nevertheless requires a cause for its current existence. If an eternal universe requires a cause, how much more does one that began to exist? And since we now have strong reasons to conclude that the cosmos began to exist, we are driven to the conclusion that the universe's coming into existence required a cause for its production. What is the alternative? Anthony Kennedy answers by saying, a proponent of the Big Bang theory, at least if he is an atheist, must believe that the matter of the universe came from nothing and by nothing. When one thinks about this for just a few seconds, this alternative becomes impossible. It would entail that there was absolutely nothing. Now, mind, energy, matter, space, nothing, no potential. And then poof, for no reason at all, and by nothing at all, matter, energy, space, time popped into existence. We don't possess enough faith to embrace such an absurd conclusion. But it gets worse for those who wish to deny our conclusion. For if the causal premise has exceptions, if it is possible for quarks and universes to pop into being uncaused out of nothing, then anything goes in the natural realm, and science becomes impossible. Both theists and atheists have agreed on this point. Hawking, for example, informs us that while many people have welcomed the fact that there was a singularity in which all the laws of physics didn't exist, it always profoundly disturbed me, he says. If the laws of physics could break down at the beginning of the universe, why couldn't they break down anywhere? In the quantum theory, it is a principle that anything can happen if it is not absolutely forbidden. Once one allows that singular histories could take part in the path integral, they could occur anywhere and predictably would disappear completely. If the laws of physics break down at singularities, they could break down anywhere. If the laws of physics can break down anywhere at any time, then we have lost all warrant for doing science. In Hawking's words, we can no longer make predictions about how nature will behave, which is the goal of science. For we have no good reason to think the laws of physics will be around long enough for our predictions to prove true. Think about that. If you give up the causal premise and say, oh, well, the universe could just pop into being uncaused out of nothing, then you've literally given up on science.
Can you say the opposite of that, too, that it can pop out of existence?
Yes. So there's no, you've lost all foundation for doing science. And this takes us all the way back to the transcendental argument. You have two options, God or complete absurdity.
Chaos.
That's it. As Hawking implies, if the laws of physics can break down at any moment, we must be open to the possibility that anything at any time may pop into existence uncaused out of nothing. Or as Craig and Sinclair argue, if things really could come into being uncaused out of nothing, then it becomes inexplicable why just anything or everything does not come into existence uncaused from nothing. Why do bicycles and Beethoven and root beer not pop into being from nothing? Why is it only universes that can come into being from nothing? What makes nothingness so discriminatory? There cannot be anything about nothingness that favors universes, for nothingness does not have any properties. Nothingness is the absence of anything whatsoever. As such, nothingness can have no properties, since there literally is not anything to have any properties. Nor can anything constrain nothingness, for there is not anything to be constrained. How silly, then, when popularizers say things like nothingness is unstable to quantum fluctuations or the universe tunneled into being out of nothing. The great Puritan pastor theologian Jonathan Edwards concurred with Hawking, Sinclair, and Craig. And I love these words of Edwards. He says, yea, if once it should be allowed that things may come to pass without a cause, we should be without evidence of the existence of anything whatsoever but our own immediately present ideas and consciousness. For we have no way to prove anything else but by arguing from effects to causes. from the ideas now immediately in view, we argue toward other things not immediately in view. From sensations now excited in us, we infer the existence of things without us as the causes of these things, which they depend on as effects on causes. But if things may be without causes, all this necessary connection and dependence is dissolved, and so all means of our knowledge is gone. If there be no absurdity or difficulty in supposing one thing to start out of non-existence into being of itself without a cause, then there is no absurdity or difficulty in supposing the same of millions upon millions for nothing, or no difficulty multiplied is still nothing, or no difficulty, nothing, multiply nothing, don't increase the sum. All right, so that leads us to the conclusion that there must be a cause of the cosmos. And I am going to take you, I'm going to torture you by taking you through this line of reasoning. If you skip the first paragraph of this conclusion, the conclusion remarks, and go to the last paragraph, the reader will recall that critics of the Klom argument insist that whereas the causal principle holds regarding the things or events in the universe, it does not apply to the universe itself. Hence, they assert that the universe may have come into existence uncaused, even though nothing else can. We have already seen how arbitrary such a stipulation is, for why would nothingness be so discriminatory as to favor universes as wholes rather than events or things within the cosmos? As we close our discussion of this first conclusion, we would like the reader to consider Jonathan Edwards' proleptic response to the modern critic of our argument, to those who suggest that the universe, because it is a different sort of thing than its constituent parts, could have come into existence without a cause. This is what he says. Therefore, I would observe that the particular nature of existence, be it ever so diverse from others, can lay no foundation for that thing's coming into existence without a cause. Because to suppose this would be to suppose the particular nature of existence to be a thing prior to the existence, and so a thing which makes way for existence with such a circumstance, namely without a cause or reason of existence. But that which in any respect makes way for a thing's coming into being, or for any manner or circumstance of its first existence, must be prior to the existence. The distinguished nature of the effect, which is something belonging to the effect, can't have influence backwards to act before it is. Now, what the heck is he saying? Well, I give a footnote here to exposit him, and this is what he says. To put his point another way, what is it about the universe as a whole, for example, that makes it exempt from the causal principle? Okay, so notice what the atheist is saying. A chair cannot come into existence out of nothing. A tree cannot come into existence out of nothing, but the universe can pop into existence out of nothing. So there has to be something about the universe as a whole that allows it to do that. Whatever it is, it must be a distinguishing characteristic of the universe, for it is something the cosmos has, that is, an ability to pop into being uncaused out of nothing, that is apparently not shared by events in the universe. But, of course, this characteristic of the universe must exist either before the universe came into existence or after the universe came into existence. It cannot be the latter, for if the characteristic that allows the universe to pop into being uncaused itself came into being after or simultaneously with the universe, then the very thing that allowed the universe to begin without a cause was non-existent in the moment of creation, which entails that the universe was then no longer distinguished from any other thing. That is, those events which require a cause for their beginning to be within the cosmos at the point of its origin, which in turn means that even the universe needs a cause if it came into existence. For whatever begins to exist, existence needs a cause, and there are no exceptions to this principle when there is nothing around to distinguish one kind of event from another. Thus, the distinguishing characteristic must have existed before the universe began to exist, ensuring that the universe's coming into existence would be without a cause. But this contradicts the very nature of our premise B, that is, the universe began to exist. For if the distinguishing feature of the universe existed before the universe came to be, then at least part of the universe or part of its essence existed prior to the universe's creation, in which case the universe or part of it is eternal after all. This not only contradicts our premise B, it entails that the very thing that allowed the universe to exist was the universe, which further entails that the cosmos was self-created. This, of course, is absurd, for anything self-created is something that exists before it exists, which is a contradiction. A final solution is to suggest that the cosmos, once it came into existence, immediately possessed this characteristic, distinguishing it from all others, that allowed it to come into being without a cause, a characteristic which ensured that it would pop into being for no rhyme or reason. But as Edwards states at the end of the paragraph, such a solution entails a sort of retroactive causation in which the universe's defining feature, once it came into being, ensured that the universe would be uncaused at the moment of creation, before the actual creation event. However, we submit that the forward flow of time's arrow renders backward causation metaphysically, if not logically, absurd. In any case, the scenario also entails that the universe somehow determined the mode of its arrival, which is just another form of self-creation. So J.P. Moreland, I think, is absolutely correct when he says, there's no reason to deny that what we experience is true every day. Events have causes, and so did the first one. All right. So, from this point, it just becomes gravy. It's a downhill slide. So, do y'all understand the argument up to this point? And do you understand why we say what we say? And do you understand our defense in light of the criticisms of the atheists? What are you going to get out there in the world? You're going to run into two kinds of people. You're going to run into people who never really thought about this. And they'll look at you and say, why do you think God exists? And you can say to them what I said to my 8-year-old son. I said, well, have you ever experienced anything to happen without a cause? And be as simplistic in your language as possible. You can go here with them now, right? You can start very simplistically and then move backwards. But I always say, well, have you ever experienced anything to happen without a cause? Well, no. Well, you believe in the Big Bang, don't you? And if they say no, I say, well, why? Most scientists do. And if they say, well, yes, then you say, well, the Big Bang shows that the universe began to exist. And since whatever begins to exist needs a cause, you just said so, and you grant that the universe began to exist because the majority of scientists say so, the universe must have had a cause. I've given that argument to literally hundreds of people, and they walk away going, oh, wow, I never even thought of it like that. And they believe that God exists now. End of discussion. Most people will say that. The other kind of person you'll run into is someone who doesn't believe that God exists, and this is his hobby. And so he's on YouTube watching debates with Craig and trolling with his comments and saying that Craig is getting defeated and Craig doesn't know what he's talking about. Or he's listening to Hugh Ross and he thinks Hugh Ross is a fraud. Or he's listening to some other apologist that utilizes this argument and he thinks that they're crazy. Well, with that person, you would then have to back up and start going down this road of looking at, well, why is the universe an exception to the causal premise? But if you grant that the universe has a cause, and by universe we mean the space-time continuum of existence, that matter, energy, space, and time all had a beginning at a single moment that we call the Big Bang, and that is what the Big Bang teaches. If you know all of that, then what you have is this wonderful gift that has fallen into your lap as a theist, modern science. You also have the philosophical arguments, right? And for those that may deny the science, I sometimes say, well, can you traverse an infinite? And I give the example of the man counting to zero from negative infinity. Well, if he can't reach zero counting from negative infinity, meaning he can't traverse an infinite number of moments to get to the present to zero, if the universe is eternal, we would have had to traverse an infinite moments to get to the present, but that's impossible. But the present moment has arrived, therefore the universe must be temporally finite. It must have had a beginning. So we have philosophical arguments to that effect as well.
Well, that's what I was going to ask, is what is the simplistic answer out of all that we've covered to say to somebody who in that conversation says, well, I think the universe is eternal?
I would say, well, what do you do with Stephen Hawking's statement that everyone now believes, and by everyone he means all current physicists, now believe that
modern science argues that the universe has a beginning.
Right.
In other words,
I would put it back in his court and say, why do you dispute the majority of physicists who say that the universe and time itself began to exist at the Big Bang? Why would you dispute what they're saying? And another way to put it is, why should I believe what you're saying over against people like Stephen Hawking and Albert Einstein? And if they say, well, Stephen Hawking was an atheist, yes, but the question now is whether his ways of getting around the beginning are valid. And you're prepared. We've looked at his ideas. So the question now is, what kind of cause is there? So the question at this point in the argument is not whether the universe had a cause. The question is, what kind of cause are we talking about? And so this is the next stage, and we're going to go through this very quickly. It's not going to take much time at all for us to get through with this. The cause of the universe was not caused to come into existence. Well, that should be obvious. And that should be obvious for two reasons. First, the cause of the universe caused time. That means the cause of the universe transcends time, and therefore the cause of the universe is itself not something that is an effect. Because cause and effect relations happen in time. But the cause of time itself is therefore not a part of that cause-effect relationship. So the cause of time must by definition be eternal and uncreated. Here's another reason. Let's say that you postulated that the cause of time was caused to come into being. What do you now have?
The cause of time?
If the cause of time was caused to come into existence, or to put it another way, let's say that the cause of time was an effect of another cause. What must you now conclude? There are actually two directions you can go here. Well, there are two directions you can go here. If the cause of time is an effect of some other cause, then the cause of time is not the cause of time.
Or the universe.
Well, yeah. Or the universe. Why? Because to say I'm an effect of some cause is to say that I'm temporal, is to say that I have a beginning and I'm enduring now. So if the cause of time
has a cause,
then the cause of time is not the cause of time.
No.
Here's another way to put it. If you say that the cause of time has a cause, then you're basically saying that there was a time before time.
Not rational.
And that is a paradox. That is illogical. Now, what I'm giving you is Immanuel Kant's first antinomy. You'll remember in our discussion, he said that the causal principle and the laws of logic, they cannot be applied to the universe as a whole. And why can't they? Because contradictions result as you begin to do that. And we didn't look at the antinomies, the contradictions that result when you try to apply the laws of logic to the universe as a whole. Well, this is one of them. He has four. This is the first antinomy he has. He says, let's try to take the laws, the categories of the human mind and apply them to the universe as a whole. Okay, fair enough. Well, let's ask this question. Did the universe have a beginning or didn't it? Well, if you say the universe had a beginning, the problem there is you say end up saying that there was a time before time.
Contradiction.
That's a contradiction. But if you say the universe didn't have a beginning, did not have a beginning, then you have to say that an infinite number of moments existed prior to the present, which is also a contradiction. And we've already looked at that. So what is Kant's solution? Kant's solution is we don't know. We can't apply the categories of the mind to the world as a whole or to the universe. And what is our solution? We break the horns of that dilemma. We say that the universe was not caused in time. The universe is the cause of time or is the beginning of time. So time began when the universe began. And therefore, the cause of the universe does not exist in a time before time. The cause of the universe is literally eternal. and is non-temporal, and therefore doesn't need a cause, and doesn't have a beginning. That's how you break the horns of that dilemma. Well, I say the next premise is this. The cause of the universe is not self-created or self-caused. Well, we've already gone through that a million times, haven't we? And what's amazing, Daniel Dennett, an atheist philosopher, he's part of the Four Horsemen, Hitchens, Harris, Dawkins, and Dennett. Now, Hitchens is gone now, and they usually put Lawrence Krauss now among the Four Horsemen. But Daniel Dennett said that we atheists should no longer call ourselves atheists, because it doesn't even make sense to speak of, as Sam Harris says,
what are you against?
Yeah, it doesn't make sense to say I'm an a-Santaist. You're just someone who doesn't believe that Santa exists. You don't have a label like that. Sam Harris says atheism is just common sense, right? Well, Daniel Dennett says we should no longer call atheists. We should call them brights. Why are they brights? Well, they're the ones that believe in reason, whereas you theists out there don't. Well, I want you to see how Daniel Dennett conceives of the origin of the universe. This is what he says. He says, this is a quote. What does need its origin explained is the concrete universe itself. And as Hume's Philo long ago asked, why stop at the material world? It, we have seen, does perform a version of the ultimate bootstrapping trick. It creates itself ex nihilo, or at any rate, out of something that is well nigh indistinguishable from nothing at all. Think about this. Unlike the puzzlingly mysterious, timeless self-creation of God, this self-creation is a non-miraculous stunt that has left lots of traces. And being not just concrete, but a product of an exquisitely particular historical process, it is a creation of utter uniqueness, encompassing and dwarfing all the novels and paintings and symphonies of all the artists, occupying a position in the hyperspace of possibilities that differs from all others. There are several stupid things in this statement from a man who says that I'm going to call myself a bright, and all of you stupid theists are just crazy. First, you can't create yourself, as I've said a gazillion times. Second of all, he says, it is something well nigh indistinguishable from nothing at all. If you're something, you're not well nigh indistinguishable from nothing. There's an infinite gap between something and nothing. There's a qualitatively infinite gap. There's no third option between something and nothing. Nothingness is the absence of anything whatsoever, and therefore something is very distinguishable from nothing. It doesn't matter how small it is. Let's say that a grain of sand. Now I know that a grain of sand is actually far more complex than we perceive. But let's say that a grain of sand is just as simple as our mind's eye. Excuse me, not just our mind's eye, but our physical eye sees it to be. Because we look at a grain of sand, that's very simple, right? Let's say it is that simple. And let's say that it came into existence from nothing. There's a qualitatively infinite distance between that grain of sand and nothing. And therefore, even if the universe is as simple as a grain of sand, it still needs a cause to bring it into being. It's not just the complexity of the universe. We need to get rid of this. It's not just the complexity of the universe. It's the fact that it had a start. Automatically, you have to have an explanation for that. And Daniel Dennett's answer ain't so bright. Yeah, you wanted to say something?
No, just it doesn't matter how simple it is, whatever it is.
Whatever it is, yeah. The simplest thing you can imagine, if it began to exist, it has to have a cause. Now, the other thing he says is that God is self-created? The self-creation of God? What's he talking about? Who said that God is self-created? Nobody. He doesn't know of a single theist worth his weight in gold that would ever say such a thing. There may be some like Leibniz who could be interpreted as saying that, but Leibniz never said that. Thomas Aquinas never said that. Al-Ghazali never said that. Maimonides never said that. Who is he reading among the theistic literature that would even say such a thing. So this is a crazy quote on all levels. It advocates self-creation, which is illogical. It says you can't distinguish something from nothing, which is illogical. And it says that theists believe in a self-created God, which is just factually untrue. And this leads us to the conclusion that the cause of the universe is uncreated or uncaused. And I'm going to skip over many of the things that I'm saying here because we've pretty much said everything that I'm saying here in this premise. We've already said these things multiple times. The cause has got to be metaphysically distinct from our universe. And this is Arthur Eddington says this. He says that he has an indignation for anyone who affirms the beginning of the universe, except, of course, himself. And then he says this. He says, the beginning of the universe seems to present insuperable difficulties unless we agree to look upon it as frankly supernatural. I'm on page 352 at the top of the page. And therefore, it leads us to the conclusion that we reach in the Thomistic argument. The uncaused cause of the universe's coming into existence is eternal, necessary, immutable, infinite, independent, one, omnipresent, immaterial, omnipotent, omniscient, and omnibenevolent and personal. I mean, once you grant that an uncreated cause of the universe's coming into existence exists, then that cause has to be certain things, which automatically render it to be something like the God that we have always talked about. Like, for example, how do we know that this being is eternal? We know it because it's timeless. And so we actually, with the Kalam argument, have a better understanding of eternity than we did with the Thomistic argument. With the Thomistic argument, we were open to the idea that the uncaused cause endures through an infinite time and sustains the universe. Now we believe that the uncaused cause is literally eternal, totally timeless, and therefore never had a beginning and never will have an end. Necessary? Well, let me ask you this. Does this being exist? Yes. Yes. We do believe that it does, but we believe that it does because we've proven that it does. We know that it does. It's not that we believe that it does. We know that it does. And we know that it does because of this sound argument we've given, right? So does it exist?
Yes.
Yes. Yes, it exists. And therefore it is actual, right? Does it have potential? If you say it is a mixture of actuality and potentiality, what are you saying? You're saying that it's contingent. All contingent things are a mixture of actuality and potentiality. I actually exist, but I also have potential. And that is what makes me a contingent thing. So if you say that the being is a mixture of actuality and potentiality, then you're saying that this being is contingent and therefore needs a cause. But we just proved that it's uncaused. And therefore it must be pure actuality with no potentiality whatsoever. It doesn't have the potential for change, and therefore it's immutable. And it doesn't have the potential for non-existence, which makes it absolutely necessary. All right? What can bridge the qualitatively infinite gap between something and nothing? This being did, because it brought the universe into being out of nothing. Well, the answer is only a being of infinite power, right? And therefore it must be all-powerful. And since knowledge is a kind of power, it must also be all-knowing.
Omniscient.
All right, and if it's pure actuality with no potentiality, it can't have any evil in its being because evil is a privation of being and therefore must be all good. And it also must be personal. How do we know it's personal? Well, there are only two kinds of immaterial things that can exist. And we know that this being is immaterial because it created matter. Well, how do we know that this being is a mind instead of an abstract object? There are only two kinds of immaterial things that can exist, minds and abstract objects. But abstract objects stand in no causal relationship to anything, like numbers. It doesn't make sense to say that the number 2 caused it to be the case that 2 apples exist in front of you. And therefore, the only kind of immaterial thing that could cause anything would be a mind. And since we know that an immaterial cause of the universe exists, that immaterial cause must be a mind and therefore must be personal. On page 355, I've given you all the attributes of this God, and of course you can look in more detail as to what I've written here. But if you look at the objections to our conclusion, here's a question. If actual infinities cannot exist, then God cannot exist, for he is said to be actually infinite. Right? Remember, we said that actual infinities can't exist, but now we have an actual being who is infinite. And what is the answer there? Well, the quick answer is that the actual infinity that we believe exists is one being who is qualitatively infinite. God is not an infinite number of things, right? God is actually infinite only in the qualitative sense, not the quantitative sense. Well, if everything needs a cause, who caused God? How many times do we have to answer this one? Everything does not need a cause. The universe, only things that begin to exist need a cause. And since God didn't begin to exist, he doesn't need a cause. What about this idea that the idea of a non-temporal cause of anything is incoherent? And right.
God has always been. Time began at the beginning of the universe.
Right. Let's go through his questions. He says, does God's existence have a sheer origination in time? We would say no. But then this would be as great a puzzle as the sheer origination of a material world. Or has God existed forever through an infinite time? Our answer is no. But this would raise again the problem of the actual infinite. To avoid both of these, we would have to postulate that God's own existence is not in time at all. But this would be a complete mystery. And I agree that it's a mystery, but it's not a contradiction. Okay, well, then Dan Barker says, well, no, that is a contradiction, says Dan Barker. This is what Dan Barker writes at the bottom of page 357. He says, the word create is a transitive verb. We have no experience of transitive verbs operating outside of time. So when we hear such a word, we must picture it the only way we can. A subject acts on an object. Considering the point at which an action is committed, there must be an antecedent state during which the action is not committed. And this would be true either in or out of time. Now, I agree that the word create has to have a similar meaning as our everyday experience. So when you're talking about God or us, there's an analogy there. But I want to throw this at all of you. Why not say that from all eternity, God simply willed that a temporally finite universe exist? And therefore, there was never a moment where God began to will creation. Because he did it from eternity. When did God start to create the universe? Category mistake. He didn't start to begin to create the universe. He's always created the universe. Well, if he's always created the universe, then the universe must be eternal. No, because he willed that the universe be temporally finite. Is it logically possible for God to will an eternal creation? Yes, that's logically possible. Is it metaphysically possible for our universe to be actually infinite? No. And that's proof that God did not choose to will an eternal creation. He chose to will a temporally finite creation. So he just, from eternity, willed that a temporally finite universe obtain. Now, why is that incoherent? Now Barker will go on to say on page 358, this is the second thing. He says, well, creation, causality requires temporality. He says, either in or out of time, the decision of a personal agency to commit an action happens antecedent to the action itself. even if the deciding and the acting happened simultaneously, it would still not be true that the acting was antecedent to the deciding. Imagine God saying, oh, look, I just created the universe. Now I better decide to do it. Well, God would never say that. Okay, that assumes that God occupies a certain space and a certain time. Do all cause-effect relationships require temporal antecedents? The burden of proof would be on you to prove that. All it requires is a certain kind of antecedents. And so what we would say is this: God is not temporally before the universe. He is ontologically prior to the universe. What does that mean? Well, you can use the word before in a number of senses. I can use the word before spatially. I stand before you today. Or temporally, my Father exists before I do. Or ontologically, an angel exists before I do because they transcend me ontologically. In their very being, they are greater than me. Now, we've not proven that angels exist in this, but hypothetically, if angels were to exist, then they would exist before me ontologically. Well, we would say that God stands before time ontologically. He transcends it. And therefore, he's before time in that sense. But he's not temporally before time, because then there would be a time before time. Now, my question to y'all is, how is that incoherent? I'm asking about what I just said. Is that clear to y'all? I mean, is that a coherent idea?
Yes.
Yeah, I don't think that there's...
Yes, I can't exactly put it into words.
Yeah, if it sounds reasonable that there could possibly be a being that stands ontologically prior to our world such that he could eternally will something to be, and it obtain in time, I just don't see how that is an incoherent idea. What this means is, like, here's the question: when did God begin to redeem us? If I can speak theologically now as Christians, there was never a time when God began to redeem us. Right? He didn't go, oh gosh, man has fallen. Oh no, what do I do? Oh, I know what I'll do. All that assumes spatial relationships and temporal relationships to God. He doesn't. That's not God. God is so much bigger than that. He, from eternity, willed our redemption. And so, when did God begin to act for us? He never began to act for us. He's always been acting for us. But the effects of his will fall out in time. So 90% or 99% of the little puzzles that people throw at you are category mistakes. It's like, when did the bachelor stop beating his wife? Well, that's a category mistake. Sometimes you have to reject the question. So when sometimes people come up to you and say, there's a contradiction in the idea of God, a lot of times it's because they're thinking of God in spatio-temporal ways, when the fact of the matter is the God we worship is beyond space and beyond time. Now I know we are at 11:15, so I want to finish the calm argument today, and all we have maybe at most is 3 minutes. So I apologize for keeping y'all so long, but I'm about to go on a trip, and I don't want to have this hanging over me. So I want to say one or two more things about God and time. There are two ways to picture God and time. You can either say that God is extrinsically changing with respect to time, or that God is both extrinsically and intrinsically changing with regard to time. Now, what is an example of the two? Well, look at the relationship between me and my son. I mean, my son just graduated from high school, but there was a time where I could hold Evan in my hand. I could hold him out like this. He would rest his head in my hand, and his body went through here, and his legs would sort of be curled up, you know, and I could just do this with Evan. Okay, can I do that now? He's 18 years old, and he's graduated from high school. I cannot do that. Evan has experienced a lot of intrinsic changes from the time he was born until this very moment right here. And so he's been changing with respect to me intrinsically as well as extrinsically. He himself has changed. He's grown in knowledge and wisdom, and he's learned a lot of things. He's learned how to play the guitar. He's learned how to play soccer. He's done a lot of things. He's internalized things. He's grown as a person. He's also changed extrinsically. With respect to me, he was this much shorter than me. He was, 18 inches when he was born. So he was 18 inches tall when, with respect to me, I'm 6 feet tall. So there's been an extrinsic change because now he's less shorter than me than he was. He's like up to here. Now let's say that Evan were to grow to be taller than me. Then he would change from being shorter than me to taller than me. And that's all because of these changes going on in him. So those are intrinsic changes that have happened to Evan. Well, what about me? Now, I know that I've changed too, but for the analogy purpose, in terms of my height, have I changed with respect to my son at any time when you look at my height? No. And let's say that Evan grows to be taller than me, and that can still happen. He's still not full grown yet. Then I would change from being taller than Evan to being shorter to Evan. But is that because of any change in me? No, it's because of changes in him. And so I am extrinsically changing with respect to Evan. He is both intrinsically and extrinsically changing with respect to me. And that is how God is with the universe. God is extrinsically changing with the universe. As Thomas Aquinas says, when God cannot be called Lord until he brings the universe into existence because he has to have something to be Lord over. And that represents an extrinsic change of God with respect to the universe. So when God brings the universe into existence, there is a change. And it is a change that God experiences. But it's not an intrinsic change to God. He still remains atemporal and keeps the universe in being. And these moments in time can come and go, and he always remains intrinsically immutable with respect to the universe, no matter what changes obtain. And you can see this if you want to use biblical examples. In Hebrews, it starts off by saying, God has revealed to us himself to us in many times, over many times and in many ways, but now he has definitively revealed himself to us in his Son. And who is the Son? Well, the author of Hebrews will go on to say, the Son is the same today, yesterday, and forever. Right? So, how does the Son change? He only changes extrinsically, not intrinsically. Or how does God change? He only changes extrinsically, not intrinsically. Does that make sense to y'all? All right, so that is... The analogy is very... And I wish I had come up with it, but I didn't. So... 362, the uncaused cause or uncreated creator greatly resembles the God of classical monotheism. That should be obvious. In fact, if you go to the next premise, it says that God, therefore a God much like the one described by classical monotheism exists. All of the attributes theists have predicated upon the God of classical monotheism are true of the creator of the cosmos. And since the creator of the cosmos exists, we must conclude that the God of classical monotheism exists. One confession, the Westminster Shorter Catechism, tells us that God is a spirit, infinite, eternal, and unchangeable in his being, wisdom, power, holiness, justice, goodness, and truth. The statement was given long before the cosmos's origin came to light, at least scientifically. And we are amazed that the conviction that God is, as well as who God is, has been confirmed through both philosophical reflection and scientific observation. And so I end my discussion of the Kalam argument with these really fun words of Robert Jastrow. And this is how I'll end this whole lecture. He says this, "At this moment, it seems as though science will never be able to raise the curtain on the mystery of creation. For the scientist who has lived by his faith in the power of reason, the story ends like a bad dream. He has scaled the mountains of ignorance. He is about to conquer the highest peak. As he pulls himself over the final rock, he is greeted by a band of theologians who have been sitting there for centuries.